If it's Thursday, 6 p.m., that means it's time for Perspectives by John Pierce. Glad to have you with us this evening. Our engineer is James Zibrot, and our topic this evening is the 1876 Centennial Celebration in Philadelphia. My guest has done much historical study. His name is John Hepp, and let me tell you a little bit about his background. Growing up just outside of Philadelphia, John Hepp can never remember not being interested in history, in part because he was always surrounded by the physical reminders of the past, indeed, around Philadelphia. One of those reminders of the past was regularly playing skee ball in South Jersey. John, this has to be a misprint.
Oh, no. As a child, because remember, we're talking about the 1960s now.
All right.
We would drive down to New Jersey, and my parents would stop at a bar midway somewhere. And so as my father would have a drink of beer and my mother would have something to eat, they would send me off to play skee ball. And it got to be fun because I was 5 years old, maybe. And
5 years old.
And, you know, and I had no fear. So I had incredibly high scores. And so the other people at the bar would spot me. I think it was a dime to play skee ball back then, would spot me like rolls of dimes. And I would just play it for the whole time my parents were
okay.
there.
Okay. Is this the one with the bowling type alley?
No, it's the one that you kind of go up in the air. You throw it. And
concentric circles.
Yeah, yes.
Yes. And the closer to the center, the more points.
That is great.
That's skee ball.
Yep.
Okay, good. This is a reminder of the past. That's one of your very favorite recollections as a child, right?
Yes.
And that would feed into John Hepp's work as historical consultant on a recent book and documentary project. His path to teaching at Wilkes University. Yes, you are now retired.
I am now retired from
Wilkes. Okay. How many years at Wilkes University?
25.
Ooh, that's a career. He thinks that his time spent practicing law helped him to be both a better teacher and mentor to his students. Now, we have skee ball, and we have professor at Wilkes University, and now we have law. So you went to law school besides what you've done with history.
That is correct.
And you went to Penn.
I went to Penn Law.
And you practiced law for about 5 years?
5 years, 4 months, and 3 days.
Oh, not to put such an exact number on it. And when you were at Wilkes, you taught courses on U.S. history and world history, 1600 to the present, effects of technological and economic change on everyday middle-class urban life was one of your favorite topics. Fascination with international law is another. So the University of Pennsylvania Law School practiced law in Philadelphia. John, since you are from the Philadelphia area, I'm going to ask you this question. I'm from the Chicago area and have heard all my life that if you wanted a really great lawyer, Philadelphia lawyer is the thing. Is that true around Philly? Do people talk like that?
Actually, yes, because Philadelphia lawyers, it's a very early reputation that actually dates to the colonial period, that Philadelphia lawyers were particularly sharp, shall we say. Mm-hmm. And I used to joke because I was hired by people in New York precisely because I was a Philadelphia lawyer.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. And so you began at Wilkes in 1999. Now you're retired from that teaching, but you continue to teach just like in this interview. And in fact, I met John Hepp at the Lehigh Valley Historical Museum where he gave a talk. So that means you're continuing to teach. And let's give a shout out there to Jim Higgins and to Jill Youngkin.
Definitely.
They do such a great job over there. If that's not enough with Dr. Hepp's activities, he co-produced student-led historical documentaries between 2002 and 2010. and led study abroad tours to London. Oh, I bet the students got a kick out of that. I can see you as a tour guide.
And it was actually wonderful, because the great thing about leading study abroad is every trip to London was my students' first trip to London.
Yes.
So I always saw London through their eyes.
Yeah, that's a great point. Now, let's get on to, you haven't just been sitting on your hands. Your most recent book is Mystery and Marvel, Philadelphia's 1876 Centennial Exposition, published in 2024. So that is Dr. John Hepp, Esquire. Let's just give you the full benefit of everything. And you live in a 120-year-old arts and crafts house. Now, John, be honest with me. Does that mean it's about to fall apart?
Oh, it's been falling apart since it's built. So one of the joys of being in an old house, like we just had in the winds that we had last year, we actually had a window that the window frame just broke. So yeah. I have to find someone who can repair a 120-year-old window frame.
And keep it looking like the original, right?
That is correct.
And that's in Ballykinwood, so you're still in the Philadelphia area, and with your wife, son, and Jack Russell Terrier. All right, that means you're a big fan of the sitcom Frasier.
Yes.
Oh, is that the reason you have a Jack Russell Terrier?
No. I'm a dog whisperer. Dogs tend to come to me and fall in love with me. I have no idea why. And this Jack Russell Terrier had been put up for adoption 3 separate times and run herself out of all the previous homes. Then she's been living with me for the last 5 years.
So let's get to our topic this evening, which is the 1876 Centennial Celebration in Philadelphia. John, one thing that I like about your talking about this topic is that you give us a context of what world expositions were like. The first one, and then through a couple of centuries of them. And where do we start with that?
Well, we actually start in 1851 in London, because Prince Albert decided to give his beloved wife, Queen Victoria, a wonderful present. And that present was the first World's Fair. And say in 1851, and the whole idea was to prove to the world that Britain was the industrial empire that just towered over everyone. And so, of course, after that, the French want to show, no, we are the industrial empire that towers over everyone. And then the Austrians wanted to do it. And so for the first 24 years, all the world's fairs were in Europe. And so in 1876, the centennial becomes a world's fair, and it's the first world's fair in the United States.
In Philadelphia.
Yep.
Paint us a little picture of what it would have been like to walk onto the grounds of the World's Fair. And by the way, where was it in Philadelphia?
Okay. The World's Fair was in Fairmount Park West. And a matter of fact, if you go there today, the Please Touch Museum, which is a children's museum, is in one of the surviving buildings of the Centennial. And the kind of really cool thing about the Centennial is the street layout of the Centennial is still the street layout of Fairmount Park. So you can walk down all the streets that existed in 1876. And so the first thing is when you showed up, and this is very strange because we're used to it today, but you got in by going through a turnstile. And this was the first time anywhere in the world that turnstiles had been used to count admission to any sort of event. And so that's why we know exactly how many people went through those turnstiles, because each person was counted as they went through. And as I say, we're used to it. We board a subway train anywhere today, and there's going to be some sort of turnstile. But back then, it was cutting-edge technology. So you lined up. It was expensive. It was 50 cents. And this is when your average worker probably only earned about a dollar a day. So a 50-cent admission was a lot of money. You paid your 50 cents. You went through this turnstile, and suddenly before you was a world that looked nothing like Philadelphia outside the gates. Because if you go to Philadelphia today, sort of like, if you will, in both Bethlehem and Allentown, you know, it's a city of fairly small, for the most part, row houses and stores put together and on a crowded grid pattern. When you went in, there was no grid. There were just these flowing streets and these wide boulevards. There was a lot of space between the buildings, which were sort of all freestanding, so you could walk from place to place. Some of the buildings were the largest buildings in the United States at the time. And in fact, the main exhibition building was a block and a half in Philadelphia blocks, which are longer than most cities' blocks, long. So you could be inside a building and look for a block and a half. It was truly an amazing experience. And the neatest thing about it is, if you go to Disney World or Disneyland, is now there's this cute little old-fashioned train that takes you around. Well, back then, there was a cute, but it wasn't old-fashioned, because steam locomotives were cutting-edge, train that took you around the grounds. So if it's a hot day and you wanted to cool off, you could just hop on the train, pay your 5-cent fare, go around the grounds and see everything. Or if you didn't feel like walking all the time, each time you boarded, you paid a 5-cent fare and could just go to the next station along the line.
Well, interesting. How did Philadelphia come to be the city to recognize the centennial in 1876?
It was actually a very big political fight. This is the United States, so everything is always a great big political fight. Essentially, it came down to three cities were the favorites to do it. Boston wanted to do it because, well, Boston wants to do everything. And New York wanted to do it because, even more than Boston, New York wants to do everything. And so, not surprisingly, the New York Times said there's only one logical choice, New York City. Equally not surprisingly, the Boston papers agreed Boston was the best place. And there got to be something of a political argument going on. And essentially, Philadelphia lucked out for two reasons. Reason one was geography. Boston is off in a corner, so it'd be very expensive for people to get there by train. And it didn't have a lot of convenient steamship service to Europe, so it would be more expensive for people coming from Europe. While Philadelphia and New York had the same advantages, but the New York Central Railroad said it wasn't going to cut its fares for the centennial, while the Pennsylvania Railroad said, sure, we'll cut our fares. And so that helped get people to think, hey, Boston's out of the way. New York doesn't seem to be focused on the centennial, and Philadelphia is the best option.
And so Philadelphia it was.
Yep.
What was the population of Philadelphia at that time?
It's about 800,000 people.
Compared to today?
It's 1.5 million, basically.
Yeah.
Philadelphia would break a million basically in 1900. And it was, at the time, the second largest city. You said you're from Chicago.
Right.
And through most of modern, for a lot of modern history, Chicago was the second largest city. Essentially, from the founding of the country all the way up to 1880, Philadelphia was the second largest city.
Oh, not Boston, but Philadelphia.
Yeah.
We're going to have to take a break in just a second. And I want to come back, and we're talking with Dr. John Hepp about the celebration, the Centennial Exposition in Philadelphia in 1876. And now that we're in 2026, this is a big year for us to think about our history. When we come back, we're going to talk about a rapport between the Civil War and the Exposition of 1876. I can't believe there actually is one, but John Hepp says there is, so here we are. So hang in there, folks, and we will be back in just a moment. This is Perspectives by John Pierce on WDIY.
WDIY presents a selection of award-winning podcasts that air weeknights from 6 to 7 p.m., Listen to important conversations regarding art, science, business, health, and more here in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Check our website for new topics and archived programs. WDIY podcasts are on 88.1 FM, streaming at wdiy.org, on the app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back talking history this evening. It's the Philadelphia Centennial Exposition of 1876 with Dr. John Hepp. John, apparently there's some sort of rapport between the Civil War and this exposition in Philadelphia in 1876. What is the tie there?
Well, the tie is one of those strange ones. And again, it's American history, so all connections are strange connections. But when the Civil War ended, because it ended by a group of armistice between soldiers that were fighting on the field, there was no peace treaty. So there was really no formal ending and bringing America back together, and there got to be a big debate over the future of America. And there were a group of people that thought, well, one of the things that we can do to get everyone together again is have a 100th anniversary of the founding of the United States. So we're going to have this really wonderful fair. And what was sort of interesting is it both kind of worked and kind of didn't work. It worked in the sense that focusing on this exhibition allowed essentially the Northeast and the Midwest to show Europeans America's back together and we are a mighty industrial power. Southerners were less buying into that story, if you will. What Southerners focused on, and what I always love about it, is my book focuses primarily on the World's Fair itself. But in fact, 1876 was the centennial year, and there were celebrations all over America. There were towns in Massachusetts that were celebrating the fact that we were 100 years old before you were even a country. And then there were towns in Alaska that were celebrating the fact, hey, we only got into this country 9 years ago, and we were only founded 5 years ago. So we're a brand new portion of the American story. So what the centennial allowed people to do was focus on how are you going to tell America's story. And in essence, it's kind of, to me, what I love about the centennial is most people who examine the centennial say it wasn't about the past at all. It was all about the future and about America moving forward. But in fact, there was a lot about American history there. And so how I always describe it to my students is the 19th century, between 1800 and 1900, the story of the United States is from an agricultural republic to an industrial empire. And the centennial was the first time that America as a country got to advertise itself as we are that industrial empire. And you mentioned you were from Chicago. And so in 1893, Chicago is going to have a World's Fair, the second American World's Fair. And what people are going to do is say, see, we've even made progress over 1876.
So first it was Philadelphia, 76, then it was Chicago,
93.
And have we had World's Fair since then?
Oh, yeah, we had a lot. I mean, what's sort of funny is I don't think there's been a World's Fair in the United States since Knoxville in the 1980s. But for a period from essentially 1893 to about 1967, 67 is the Canadian World's Fair, but that period in there, there's a ton of America's World's Fair. New York holds them twice, once in 39 and 40, and then again in 1964. There's one in St. Louis in 1915. There's one in Buffalo. So almost all the industrial centers of the United States eventually have one.
Right. And speaking of St. Louis, 1904 was a big one.
Yes.
Meet me in St. Louis, Louis.
Yes.
Meet me at the fair.
Yeah. Yeah. And what you'll find is countries have runs of World's Fairs. I mean, Britain's last World's Fair was in the 1950s. You know, they did 1850s to the 1950s, and they did it a couple of times. France hasn't had one for almost as long. It was just prior to World War II in their case, so the 1930s. And so now the World's Fairs are almost all in Africa, the Middle East, or Asia.
Interesting. So the book that John Hepp has referred to, his book is Mystery and Marvels, Philadelphia's 1876 Centennial Exposition. It tells stories of folks who attended the exposition. Tell us a couple of stories that you have in the book.
Yeah. What I'm always fascinated by is using people to guide me through things. And so what I would do is I spent about 5 years of my life reading every diary entry I could find on the centennial. And I would follow people. In essence, I would be a peeping Tom 100 years after the fact and follow people around as they went to the centennial. And so what I like about the stories is they're all different. Because if you think about it, if you now go to, I think the closest thing we have in the United States today, a World's Fair, would be something like Walt Disney World, a really big amusement park. Everyone has a different experience there. Some people love it. Some people hate it. Some people do these things. Some people do totally different things. And that's what happened at World's Fairs. So people were able to follow in 1876 whatever they were interested in. And at the time, newspapers were the leading way of getting news out. So all the newspapers published guides to the World's Fair and would say, if you're going to be at the World's Fair for one day, this is what you have to do. If you're going to be there for 3 days, this is what you have to do. If you're going to be there for a week, this is what you have to do. And what's sort of funny is a lot of people followed that advice. But one of the people I loved following, he was a prison guard, interestingly enough, a young man from Hamilton, Ontario, that took an overnight train sitting up in a coach seat all night long between Hamilton and Philadelphia. Basically took him a day and a half to do it. And when he showed up, he was convinced he was going to love everything, and he got up early in the morning and stayed at the fair until it closed. And after 4 days, he was bored senseless. He had said he had seen everything he wanted to see, and he did not want to see any new mechanical miracles again for the rest of his life. And so instead, just took the train to the Jersey Shore, took the train up to New York City, until it was time for him to go back. And to me, I could see myself doing the same thing, because I have a true confession in life. Despite writing on World's Fairs, I've only ever been to one World's Fair in my life, and that was the 1967 Canadian Centennial in Montreal. That's the only World's Fair I've been to, and I was a little kid, and I loved it, but I was actually bored senseless by my third day there because it was just too overwhelming.
Right.
So my little prison guard had the same experience I did about 15 years later in life than I had it. And then there was this woman who lived in West Philadelphia, and if people know Philadelphia, West Philadelphia is the section that runs close to Fairmount Park. So she lived down toward what is now the Drexel campus, but back then it was just a middle-class residential neighborhood. And she probably went to the World's Fair, I don't know, 60 or 70 times in the course of its run. And she saw everything, but basically an hour at a time, which I thought is kind of interesting thing, but she didn't get overwhelmed.
Yes.
I'm going to go and see the Japanese exhibition today. And she'd go and see the Japanese one. And then she'd go home, because basically she was wealthy enough she could pay the admission. She was wealthy enough she could pay. They didn't have trolleys yet. These were horse-drawn streetcars on the street, but she could pay the fare on the horse-drawn streetcar. And so to her, it was kind of like, what I imagine is someone who lives in Orlando and has one of those annual passes to Disney World or Universal Studios and just goes a little bit whenever they need something fun to do.
Yes. And you mentioned how many times this woman went. So that brings up the question, when did the exposition open and when did it close?
It opened on May the 10th and it closed on November the 10th. Now, the most wonderful thing about this is, because, again, this is the 19th century, that It was supposed to open on May the 1st, but it took them an extra week and a half to actually get everything more or less together.
We can understand that.
Yes.
And so you mentioned a Japanese exposition. Does this mean that many countries put in expositions at this?
Yes, they did. It was not like, well, what I call modern World's Fair. The one that I went to, you went to a building. Like, for example, the building I loved most of all in 1967 was the Chinese building, because it is still the People's Republic of China closed to the West that did not even have diplomatic relations with the United States at the time, yet you'd go in a building that everything in the building was run by the Chinese government. And it was incredibly interesting because they laid things out in different ways. They explained their story in different ways. What happened at the Centennial is most of the exhibits were in big buildings. And so each country or colony or entity would have its little space within the big building. And what I loved about it is you talked about what did people do that you kind of, and what people did that you don't think about is you could buy things for your house there. For example, there was an official Japanese exhibit in the main building, and then there was a little Japanese exhibit outside the main exhibition building, which instead sold stuff, reproductions of what you could see in the main building. And so a lot of people have argued that the interest in all sorts of Asian art that comes in the 19th century, late 19th century, in part comes from the Centennial, because people went to the Centennial, bought all this neat stuff from Asia that they had never seen before, and then department stores suddenly said, wait, we can get stuff from Asia too. We can sell stuff. And so suddenly you got this boom in you know, Asian art, Asian pottery.
Uh-huh. Were there exhibits about the agriculture in the U.S., or was it all pointing toward industry?
There were lots of exhibits about agriculture. Two of the five main buildings were concentrating on agriculture. One was called Agriculture Hall and looked like this massive barn. And the other one was Horticulture Hall, which, you know, had different flowers and plants and everything like that. But one thing to realize is, especially up to the Civil War, most U.S. inventions had to do with agriculture. And so consequently, what we think of agriculture today is not how they viewed agriculture in 1876. Everything in agriculture was cutting edge. Did you have the latest plow? Did you have the latest type of seeds? Were you using the newest fertilizer? And so, in an odd sense, the line that we draw today between industry and agriculture, they didn't even think about in 1876. And I actually think, because one of the nice things of teaching at Wilkes is I had a lot of farmers' kids in my classroom over the years. And I will tell you, if you talk to your average Pennsylvania dairy farmer, they think they're just as cutting edge as any bit of American industry is today, because they need all sorts of cutting edge stuff to do their job.
That's really interesting that we make a line between agriculture and industry today that they didn't in the old days. You say that on May 10th, when the exposition in Philadelphia opened in 1876, it was rainy and overcast. You got that from the newspapers of the day?
I got that from newspapers of the day, and also my diarists, who would write down wonderful information like that. But one of the neat things about the Centennial is everything that happened there was covered. So I not only know what my visitors saw, I know what newspapers all over the United States that sent reporters there saw and they would comment on.
You've mentioned the exposition being in several buildings. Are they still standing in Philadelphia?
The only one that's still standing, fittingly enough, is the one that's the Please Touch Museum, and was built as, it was called the Art Gallery while the Centennial was going on, but it was built as Memorial Hall, and the idea was it was going to stand for all time, and it does. Two of the biggest buildings, the main exhibition building and the industrial building, were designed to be taken apart at the end of the centennial. They actually hung around for about 5 years, because after the centennial was over, people said, wow, we can just keep on doing this. And like each year, there got to be less people that were interested in seeing, you know, industrial exhibits and things like that. But yes, the one building still survives. The other thing that still survives that I always love is there are two of the five comfort stations. Now, comfort stations are public bathrooms, and two of them still survive. One of them is used on again and off again as a public restroom in Fairmount Park. Every so often, it'll open up and they'll renovate it, and then it'll need to be renovated again, so they'll close it for a few years.
So this is very useful information for listeners who might be going to Fairmount Park.
Yes.
Dr. John Hepp, our time is up. Thank you so much for coming over and enlightening us about the exhibition in Philadelphia in 1876. See, just a love of history that you have. It's great.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, sir. And to our faithful engineer, James Zibert. Thank you.
Thank you.
And to our listeners, thanks for tuning in. I'm John Pierce. Until we meet again, remember to be gentle with your neighbor.